Thank you for being here this morning. I am substituting for Chess because he has the day off, and I wanted to talk with you this morning about a passage that is in today's reading for the lectionary because it seems so appropriate to where we are as a nation and where we are as a congregation. I've entitled this sermon, In Christ's Transcendent Community, Overcoming Identity Differences. So the passage that we'll be focusing on is Galatians 3, 26 through 28. So in Christ Jesus, you are all children of God through faith, for all of you who were baptized into Christ have clothed yourselves with Christ. There is neither Jew nor Gentile, neither slave nor free, nor is there male and female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. So said Apostle Paul in his letter to the churches of Galatia. But what did he mean by this? And what implications do these sweeping statements have for this congregation today? Maybe it would help if we talked a little bit about where Galatia was. In Galatians, Paul addressed churches on the eastern side of the Mediterranean in a region of Asia near its land bridge to Europe. Galatia was then a province in Asia called Asia Minor, east and mostly south of modern Istanbul, Turkey. By Paul's time, the area had experienced centuries of war and conflicting cultural and religious influences, including Jewish monotheism and Greco-Roman polytheism. See that bluish line that starts on the right side of the screen? That represents Jews beginning to move into Asia Minor around 538 BC. That was the year, as you may remember, when Persia overcame Babylon, ended the Babylonian captivity of Jews, and then began to dominate Asia Minor. But Europeans began to rule Asia Minor about 200 years later. Alexander the Great of Macedonia conquered Asia Minor in 333 BCE. And that's what that green line means. See how it crosses over from Macedonia, right just a little south of where Istanbul is today, into Galatia. And it wasn't all that long after that that Pompey the Great finished Rome's conquest of Macedonia by 66 BCE. So by Paul's time, relations between Jews and Gentiles were very tense. Greek invaders gained control over Jerusalem in about 320 BCE. A later group of Greek rulers assumed control in 198 BCE. And this is a big one, in 156 BCE, those Roman rulers profaned the second Jewish temple by sacrificing a pig on its altar. How offensive was that, the Jews? And the Roman Empire took over Jerusalem from the Greek overlords in 63 BCE. So, especially given this history, many Jews resented deeply pagan religious influence. They expected the Messiah, promised in their scriptures, to defeat their pagan rulers and return them to independence. Yet, and unsurprisingly, some Jews also interacted with the dominant Roman culture. Some had abandoned their traditional Jewish religious practices, and some began to associate freely with Gentiles. Many from Jewish backgrounds strongly objected to this, and they thought that they should adhere to their traditional Jewish religious practices. Put simply, the region was a boiling cauldron of competing cultures and conflicting religious ideas. Sound familiar? We're not going to go there today. Let's talk about somebody who around that time did something important. A promising young Jewish scholar named Saul. He grew up in Tarsus, a town near the Mediterranean coast, just south of Galatia. And as you can see from that red line up at the top where Tarsus is, Saul moved from Tarsus to the traditional Israelite capital of Jerusalem to pursue his studies under the best Jewish religious teachers. And they shaped Paul's worldview. Describing it later, he noted his pride in his religious heritage. Circumcised on the eighth day of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, in regard to the law of Pharisee, as for righteousness based on the Jewish law, faultless. At the time, Saul apparently followed the dichotomies of ethnicity, bondage status, and gender common to his upbringing. But also around that time, some Jews had come to believe that a rabbi from Nazareth named Jesus was the Messiah promised in their sacred texts. That idea was very controversial, especially among Jewish traditionalists who controlled the Jewish temple. Roman authorities put Jesus to death on the cross on the ground that he had been an insurrectionist. And many Jews stumbled over the idea that Messiah would be crucified by Roman overlords. And Gentiles thought the idea that people could shamefully execute a divine being was just foolish. But those who believed that Jesus was the promised Messiah claimed that God had revived Jesus' dead body. Other Jews denied this. And many Greeks thought that anyone who believed in resurrection must be crazy. Given these developments and his traditionalist worldview, Saul vigorously attempted to purge Jewish communities of persons who had come to believe that Jesus was the promised Messiah. On his way to prosecute persons who had come to believe Jesus was the promised Messiah, the risen Christ appeared to Saul. You can read about this in Acts chapter 9. This blinding encounter with Jesus transformed Saul's religious beliefs and the very course of his life. His letter to Jesus' followers in Galatia implied that God himself had instructed him. When God called me by his grace and was pleased to reveal his son in me so that I might preach him among the Gentiles, my immediate response was not to consult any human being, but I went to Arabia. And that's the little line on the right side of that map where you can see the line going up to Damascus and then circling around into Arabia. That's the map drawer's understanding of where Saul probably went after his encounter with the resurrected Jesus. And Saul began referring to himself by a changed name. His parents had given him a name that referred back to Israel's first kings. But after his encounter with Jesus, he used a Latin name that meant small or humble. Well, we talked about those dichotomies of identity, and it's really important to understand what they were and where they came from as we grapple with what Galatians 3, 26 through 28 mean. First, there's the one about ethnicity. Were you Jewish or were you a Gentile? And then there's the one about bondage status. Were you a slave or were you free? And lastly, there's one about gender. Were you male or were you female? We see all of these in Galatians 3:28. And Paul's letter to the Galatian churches addresses a very heated controversy. On one side were traditionalist Jews who wanted to continue their existing religious practices and identities, just as Paul once had, but who had accepted Jesus as the promised Messiah. On the other side of the controversy were persons, including Gentiles, who had come to believe in Jesus as Messiah, but considered some Jewish rules no longer applicable. After his encounter with the risen Jesus, Paul was firmly in that second group. Paul knew the attitudes and behaviors of the first group because they had once been his own. Classic rabbinic sources, as later recorded in the Jewish Talmud, and you can see the citation there, Menachot 43b, and if you want to chase down on the internet exactly what this says, there's the site for you, had instructed daily prayers by men that said that a man was to thank God for not making him three things: not making him a Gentile, not making him a slave, and not making him female. So those were the three identity markers for Jews of Paul's day: ethnicity, bondage status, and gender. And these tend to separate people, including in Galatian churches, from each other. Now, think about that prayer from the Talmud. Paul followed this trio of markers in Galatians 3:28, but notice, he reversed them, boldly proclaiming God's intention in new faith communities to empower people to be unified despite these characteristics. Achieving this divine objective involves breaking down tribalistic barriers that ordinarily separate humans. And in the verse immediately following the one that we read at the outset, Paul explained why. If you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. This verse, verse 29, refers to God's promise to bless all peoples on earth through Abraham and his offspring. And you can read about those promises in Genesis 12 and 28, respectively, to Abram and his grandson, Jacob. But you know, people in Paul's time and ours tend to prefer others that they perceive as very similar to themselves. In God's kingdom, we should work to overcome such barriers and prejudices, just as Paul taught in these verses in Galatians 3. Perhaps this is part of the upside-down world that Jesus promised. Many who are first will be last, and many who are last will be first. So let's talk first about this ethnic difference and overcoming it. In Galatians 3:28, Paul first mentions — let's advance the slide one further. In Galatians 3:28, Paul first mentions the identity marker of ethnicity. Galatian churches had begun to overcome ethnicity distinctions, but then reverted. And in the Galatian letter, Paul identifies two ways in which this happened and how Paul reacted. From these incidents, we can see that even the early church's leaders sometimes disagreed. First, he says, ethnic separation occurred in table fellowship. In Galatian churches, friendly fellowship between Jews and Gentiles had occurred. But then some traditionalists from Jerusalem appeared, and Peter and other Jews stopped eating with Gentiles. Paul vigorously criticized them, noting that on this issue, he had opposed Peter to his face, he says, in Galatians 2:11. Whatever their ethnic background, Paul thought Christians should eat together. Second, traditionalists taught that Jesus' followers should continue to require males to be circumcised as a religious practice. And you know, we can understand their position. Christianity emerged from a branch of Judaism. Traditionalists presumably pointed to the requirement of circumcision in God's covenant with Abraham and the law of Moses. For Jews, males were circumcised to mark them as included among God's people and different from the dominant Greco-Roman culture. Various other biblical passages demonstrate that in early communities of Christians, a major doctrinal debate raged over this issue. Believers who claimed that circumcision was required reportedly called themselves the circumcision and are referred to elsewhere as the circumcision group. How did Paul react? Paul, he says in Galatians 2, verse 5 and 6:15, refused to give in to them and insisted that circumcision meant nothing. He taught that the Christian community should abandon circumcision performed by human hands. Instead, he urged believers to serve God by His Spirit and put no confidence in the flesh. Today, in our country and outside Jewish communities, racial or language barriers offer perhaps the closest analogies to the ancient distinction of circumcision. Separation based on ethnicity markers has no place in God's kingdom. We should work to overcome such barriers. Some progress has been made on this in our lifetimes and in this congregation, as we have a history of working to overcome cultural barriers. Despite our two languages and differing cultural roots, we should work cooperatively to promote the congregation's overall welfare. We can do this by planning our activities together and working alongside each other. And we can participate enthusiastically in bilingual worship assemblies and fellowship meals. How about the second identity marker, bondage status? Some early Christians were slaves. Some owned slaves. And we shouldn't be surprised by this for two reasons. First, in the New Testament, we can read the names of some slaves and masters and the instructions that the New Testament provides for each group. Second, in the ancient Roman Empire, slaves comprised about 25 to 30% of the population. During Paul's day, slavery was not limited to persons of a single race. People became slaves when they could not pay their debts or their peoples were militarily conquered. Early Christianity tended to attract people from lower socioeconomic status. And so slaves were a particularly vulnerable group, and a significant portion of early Christians probably were slaves. New Testament authors understood that they lacked the means to end this deeply entrenched societal practice. So Paul told Christian slaves not to be troubled by their status. Instead, they should obey their earthly masters, quote, as if working for the Lord. Conversely, he told masters not to threaten their slaves because they had a heavenly master who does not show favoritism. I think it's particularly instructive for us to read the relatively obscure letter that Paul wrote to Philemon. Philemon was a slave master, and Onesimus had been his slave. And this letter demonstrates the presence of a master-slave relationship in early Christianity. Onesimus probably ran away from his master, and while gone, accepted Jesus as Lord. Paul urged Philemon to take Onesimus back. He told Philemon to see Onesimus no longer as a slave, but better than a slave, as a dear brother. That's in verse 16. Conversely, 1 Timothy 6, 1 and 2 tell slaves to give their masters full respect, even to masters who are fellow believers, because this relationship makes them dear and should cause them to be devoted to the slave's welfare. So these instructions provide some perspective about what Paul likely meant by his ringing statement that neither slave nor free exist among those in Christ. Paul did not deny the reality of bondage. And by Galatians 3:28, he did not mean merely that God wanted to redeem both slaves and masters on similar terms. Yes, he wanted that, but that wasn't all. Paul meant that he wanted slaves and masters to associate as brothers and sisters in Christian community. As our nation's Supreme Court would later say, in a different context, separate but equal is inherently unequal. So here's a distillation of what Paul told Christian slaves and masters. First, demonstrate respect for each other. Second, show impartiality toward each other. Third, assure support. It is fitting that we discuss this passage today because last Thursday, our nation celebrated Juneteenth, as Daniel mentioned in his prayer, marking the end in 1865 of legalized slavery in our nation. This, despite the assertion nearly 90 years before in our Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal. Yet, ending slavery required a civil war and a constitutional amendment. New Testament principles helped to transform sentiments, enabling emancipation. Consider Lincoln's implicit invocation of Jesus' golden rule, as I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master. He wrote that in 1858. But in our country, and even in Christian communities, slavery has cast a long shadow. Unlike slavery in Paul's time in our nation, slavery had a racial component, as it was African ethnicities that were enslaved. Martin Luther King famously said that 11 o'clock on Sunday morning is the most segregated hour in America. King urged us to change this. Those descended from slaves should not be hived off in separate congregations. This idea from King and others echoes Galatians 3:28. Separating people by current bondage status or that of their ancestors does not comport with the Messiah's ethical ideas. And we should advance our heavenly master's concepts, not conform to the pattern of this fallen world. In our nation, some progress has been made on ending distinctions rooted in historical bondage status. So consider these statistics. In 1998, around 20% of white churchgoers attended exclusively white congregations. But by 2012, this figure had declined to 11%. And this change suggests that congregational separation by race today is in decline. But work remains, as one recent study suggested that many Americans continue to attend religious services where one racial or ethnic group dominates. Look around you. As you can see, from those around you and in our leadership, our congregation has been and continues to be on the vanguard of this positive change of breaking down the barriers associated with past bondage status. And thankfully, the legal end of slavery in the United States makes close analogies to the slavery of Paul's day harder to find. But exploitation through force, fraud, or coercion for labor or commercial sex persists, and Christians should support efforts to end such human trafficking. More broadly, in employee-employer relations, Christians should follow the principles undergirding New Testament instructions by demonstrating respect, by showing impartiality, and by assuring support. That brings us to the last of the three tripartite divisions of Galatians 3:28. There, Paul mentions this third identity marker, gender. Paul asserted that in Christ, there is no male nor female. What did he mean? Obviously, Galatian Christians continued to be gendered. Of the tripart identity distinctions in Galatians 3:28, overcoming this one seems hardest in our time. That is so in part because other New Testament principles, including some in Paul's letters, constrain women in certain roles. Specifically, in families, husbands should lead. We can see that in Ephesians 5:23. And similarly, in churches, men should serve as elders. 1 Timothy 3:2 and Titus 1, verse 6. But passages defining these male responsibilities should be interpreted alongside Galatians 3:28 and the many New Testament examples that recognize and empower women. Paul repeatedly identified women as having significant roles in Christian communities. For example, in the last chapter of his letter to all in Rome who are loved by God and called to be his holy people, Paul extends greetings to 29 individuals, mostly by name. Of these 29, the first two, perhaps the most prominent, are women. And eight other women are also listed. Paul's greetings in Romans 16 are more than polite acknowledgments. They're deliberate affirmations of women's leadership and labor in the early church. By naming these women and highlighting these roles, Paul first recognizes the authority and contributions of women, especially in ministry, teaching, and hospitality. Second, he models the inclusive nature of the gospel. Echoing his own words in Galatians 3:28, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. And third, he counters cultural norms that in his time often silenced or sidelined women. Remember that prayer we discussed earlier from the Talmud? But in Galatians 3:28, Paul highlights that in Christ's upside-down community, the work of women is vital and honored. Focus on just three of the 10 women identified in Romans 16. Paul identifies Phoebe as having a specific role in the Greek of the congregation of the Greek port town of Cenchrea. The Greek word for her role could be translated as servant, but recent prominent English translations, including the NIV and the New Revised Standard, have rendered it as deacon. And importantly, Paul describes Phoebe as his benefactor and tells Roman Christians in 16 verse 2 to receive her and give her any help she needs. Well, why does he say that? In Paul's time, there was no common carrier for delivering letters. Phoebe apparently delivered Paul's letter to the congregations in Rome and perhaps read it to them or explained it to them. Second, Paul mentions Priscilla in Romans chapter 16 and describes her as his co-worker who risked her life for Paul. What do we know about her from other places? We know that she taught Apollos and provided the location for Christians to meet in her home. Third, Paul also praises Junia as a fellow Jew imprisoned with him, apparently for her role in spreading the news about Jesus. Because Paul describes her as an outstanding messenger, using a Greek word that recent English translations have rendered as apostle. These descriptions provide clues about the important roles women played in early Christian congregations. Admittedly, in early churches, women were silenced when they spoke disruptively, especially relative to their husbands. We can see that in 1 Corinthians 14. Or in ways demonstrating a lack of knowledge or modesty consistent with Christian principles. And we can see that in 1 Timothy 2. But instruction about doctrine and behavior offered the solution for this problem. And women were not generally silent, as shown by Paul's great friend Priscilla's teaching Apollos, and by the women who in modesty prayed and prophesied in Corinth, as indicated by 1 Corinthians 11. Put simply, in God's kingdom, gender matters less than we or our forebears have sometimes imagined. And some progress has been made on this problem in our lifetimes and in this congregation. For example, in our English language assemblies, we have empowered women to read and pray aloud. But work remains, and we should deepen our understanding of the scriptures, including Galatians 3:28, with patience and sensitivity to others' consciences. That brings me to my last point. And this one is integrally connected to the ideas that we've been talking about. The point is how to identify with Christ's transcendent community. As we have seen, old boundaries of ethnicity, bondage status, and gender do not define who's in and who's not in the new community of Christ. Paul calls on us to acknowledge that our relationship to God rests on recognizing Jesus as the promised Messiah. Placing such trust in Jesus is what Paul means by becoming children of God through faith. And last, here and elsewhere, Paul links such trust to immersion in water. This made sense for early Christians because Jews used such baptism as an initiation rite for converts to Judaism. By being buried in water and rising, a person placing his or her faith in Jesus identifies with his death and resurrection. Paul talks about that in Romans chapter 6. And the process spiritually clothes the newly baptized person with Christ. Paul uses this metaphor to show how God attributes Jesus' perfect life to the newly baptized person. This process is a deeply personal one. No one but you can say whether you have such trust in Jesus. No one but you can decide whether to go through water to accept the spiritual clothing of Jesus' goodness that God freely offers. But completing this process provides assurance of acceptance by God and inclusion in Jesus' spiritual community. And so in our congregation, we follow the early Christians' example of immersion of believers. If you would like to explore this matter further, I invite you to speak with one of our elders, including me, or ministers. But now we turn to the other activity that reminds us of Jesus' death and resurrection, the Lord's Supper. And as we sing this next song, please assemble around the tables in the center of this auditorium as together we remember and celebrate his broken body and shed blood.